Hi, I'm Joe Wegman. Welcome to this audio course entitled Tips on Resolving Psychotropic Medication Dilemmas. We'll begin with a brief introduction. You know, working with clients who need psychotropic medications presents several unique and thorny challenges. For example, how should you deal with clients who refuse to take their medications? How best to work with well-meaning but poorly informed family members? When does just enough medication spill over into too much? How best to improve your relationships with physicians? Here's some advice on how to meet these and other medication challenges. Helping clients overcome resistance to psychotropic medication. Why are some clients so resistant to the use of psychotropic medication? After all, medication intervention is a treatment strategy that has garnered widespread acceptance as an option for treating a vast array of mental health maladies. Here are four common reasons why clients refuse or even downright resist medication, together with strategies you can use to help them better comprehend why medication might be a viable alternative for their condition. First, the shame factor. Shame is often experienced as the voice in a client's head that judges what they do as wrong, inferior, or somehow worthless. Clearly, these shaming inner voices can do considerable damage to clients' self-esteem. For some clients, this critical judge provides a continuously negative evaluation of what they are doing, moment by moment. If medication is mentioned as a treatment option, negative self-evaluation can kick into overdrive, resulting in faulty, illogical conclusions. Two common conclusions that clients reach are: they have failed themselves because their own attempts to remedy their condition haven't worked, and they must therefore be really sick. How you can help? First, work with the client on the negative self-talk. Emphasize that the resolution of their presenting problem is a journey that may include several directional paths, and that medication is merely one of these paths. Explain that medications are not necessarily essential, not demeaning, or even redemptive. Medications are merely an option to help kickstart symptom improvement, an option that can be discontinued, preferably after consultation with their therapist and prescriber. Family interference. Face it, family members are our de facto healthcare specialists. They have likely witnessed the unpredictability and even the anguish associated with the mental health struggles of their ill family member, your client. In this sense, they are not merely uninvolved bystanders. So for clinicians who want to practice in a context of collaborative care, expanding the scope of treatment to include family members is a must. Clients who believe their family has a supportive interest in their improvement are often less resistant to the use of psychotropic medication. Unfortunately, some family members, because of belief systems ingrained over many years, actually condone resistance to medication use, setting up a potential treatment challenge. How you can help. While maintaining a healthy respect for family members' views and experiences about medication, challenge with determination their faulty belief systems, such as mental illness is a character flaw, medication is for crazy people, and medication doesn't work. Provide family members with as much information as possible, including reading material and web addresses. Answer their questions straightforwardly, as you will need them as allies in the treatment process. Ambivalence. Practitioners at all levels of experience know that getting clients to overcome their resistance toward psychotropic medication is not necessarily easy. Many clients assess the odds associated with considering medication options for some time before making the commitment to pharmacotherapy as part of the treatment process. A client's decision, therefore, may be long and drawn out. How you can help. Patience is the key. Any attempt to rush the client into a premature decision is likely to backfire. It could also compromise the therapeutic relationship. Of course, waiting for clients to decide does not mean a clinician cannot offer an opinion. On the contrary, if the clinician knows that evidence-based literature supports a pharmacological treatment of a particular condition, then this information should be conveyed to the client. Again, offering reading material and reputable web addresses can help ensure that clients have as much information as possible. Also, encourage them to ask questions and then provide straightforward answers. This will help demystify the decision-making process. In this way, the client can make informed choices regarding the importance of medication for their particular disorder. Fear. Two often expressed issues that invoke clients' fear of psychotropic medication are: A. Medication will, in some way, change who they are or alter their personality. And B. Although their troublesome symptoms may improve, intolerable side effects will be worse than the illness itself. How you can help. It is imperative that a clinician stress that prescribed medications do not alter core personality, nor do they change someone into something they're not. Explain that medication does not change behavior, but has the capacity to ameliorate symptoms that are wreaking havoc in the client's life. Inform the client that all drugs have side effects, and that some of these side effects may indeed be of concern. For example, while lithium use is linked to possible coma and even death, such circumstances are very rare and most often associated with individuals that misuse this drug and don't comply with the required blood work. In the end, clients need to know that only they can make the decision to get better. So ask your client, are you willing to tolerate some weight gain as a trade-off for feeling better and becoming more functional? Or, if weight gain becomes a bothersome issue, would you commit to working on diet modification and a regular exercise program? One of the biggest challenges for clinicians is respecting a client's decision to resist medication use, even in the face of continuing and sometimes debilitating symptoms. There's a fine line between coercing versus encouraging medication use, and the misuse of power in the clinical relationship can undermine client self-determination. Also, it's worth remembering that when it comes to medication, clients will make their own choices on their own terms and in their own time. Interaction between families and psychotropic medication. Family members can have a significant influence on a client's initial decision to utilize psychotropic medication. Family members can also influence the client's willingness to adhere to a treatment regimen once it has been started. Most clients live in families, and they are affected by their loved ones' responses to their choices. For these reasons, clinicians should welcome input from members of the client's family. After all, the responsibility of caring for a client usually falls on family members. They are not simply uninvolved bystanders. For example, it is common for family members to prompt or even coerce a client into making the initial appointment with the clinician. However, due to the stigma of mental illness and the client's concerns about being a burden to family members, the family may not be fully aware of the client's mental health status. This lack of knowledge often results from fractured relationships in the family, and the client's preference to keep family members out of the loop. Although only a few studies have examined the interaction between families and psychotropic medication, we can still extract some clinical wisdom from the sparse literature. It makes sense that caring families would be concerned about their ill family member and would therefore be affected by his or her behavior. But these studies tell us that while a collaborative approach to treatment, one that includes family members, works best, families are seldom consulted about medication or educated about the ill client's condition. Of similar concern is how little clinicians utilize family members as collateral sources of information about the ill client's previous history. Why not? Well, family work is time-consuming, and clinicians are often hamstrung by clients that won't sign informed consent documents that would allow the family to participate in treatment. Also, family work can be cumbersome from the standpoint of scheduling appointments. Getting them together can be as difficult as herding cats. What's more, time constraints, fueled by managed care imposed restrictions on the number of sessions that clinicians can conduct with clients, makes it even easier to overlook family member input. There's also the family's belief system regarding medication to consider. Now, in spite of these obstacles, clinicians are encouraged to engage clients in permitting family to participate in treatment decision-making. Clients who believe their family members have a supportive interest in their improvement are often more willing to submit to a psychotropic medication evaluation. That's because caring families hope that medication, accompanied by other non-pharmacological psychosocial treatment strategies, will ease their loved one's suffering. This can also improve relationships between the client and their family. When getting the family on board, explain why you believe a psychotropic medication evaluation is worth considering for their loved one. Maintain a healthy respect for family members' views and experiences about medication, but do challenge faulty belief systems with determination. As you would with clients, offer reading material and web addresses to family members to ensure that they have as much information as possible. Also, be sure to answer their questions as straightforwardly as possible. When you invest in client success, you need all the allies you can get. Here are 6 tips for improved relationships with physicians. Non-medical clinicians train and practice in a world that is considerably different from that of physicians. With the employment of the medical model and the liberal use of psychotropic medications to alter faulty biochemistry, knowledge and appreciation of medical culture is more important than ever in strengthening collaborative relationships with physicians. Therapists at times are reluctant to collaborate with physicians who are intimidating, boorish, insulting, controlling, or egotistical. Physicians also carry their own stereotypes of therapists as being theory-oriented, touchy-feely, or not symptom-focused. These contradicting viewpoints demand that professionals sharing client care become familiar with each other's role and respect the value of each other's views and opinions. For the non-medical clinician, though, respect for the hierarchy is a key component in building relationships with doctors. Here are 6 tips for proactively improving your interaction with physicians. Number 1. Approach physicians in an assertive, confident manner. This will endear you to doctors faster than anything else. If you find yourself apprehensive or anxious, jot down your points or questions on an index card or notepad. Be succinct and make eye contact. Number 2. If you work at an on-site system, find the main traffic area and place yourself in the middle of it. Greet physicians as they walk by with a smile and, where appropriate, a handshake. This builds goodwill, an ally you're going to need. Number 3. Establish your expertise as a competent worker and respond in a timely way to physicians who reach out to you. Do your job, do it well, and be available. Once you establish your competence, you'll become the go-to person, particularly for difficult cases. Number 4. Speak the language of physicians. This means focusing on symptoms and eschewing any theory jargon. For example, if Ms. Jones reports feeling nauseous, restless, and agitated after a few days on Cymbalta, convey these symptoms to the prescriber using these terms. This is not the time to discuss Ms. Jones' repressed memories from childhood. Number 5. Never recommend a specific medication treatment. Unless the physician has specifically asked you for a suggestion, this is an egregious boundary violation. Number 6. Understand and appreciate cultural differences. Physicians are under severe time constraints that need to be respected. Physicians take a tremendous amount of responsibility for their patients' well-being, and they facilitate change in their patients' conditions. Non-medical clinicians, on the other hand, often place responsibility for change on the backs of their patients. This difference of perspective can create a conflict between physicians and clinicians and skew their expectations of one another. Here's the key. To work collaboratively with physicians, recognize and appreciate the ways in which their role differs from your own. Now a few words about polypharmacy. Psychiatric patients are over-medicated. I hear that a lot, particularly from people who learn that I write a psychopharmacology blog. Part of me agrees, yet another part of me realizes that this is not a simple black or white issue. Instead, it's nuanced and complex. There's no consistent definition of polypharmacy in the literature, so what is it, really? How many medications are too many? The most accurate definition of polypharmacy I've come across is the administration of many drugs together. As to how many medications are too many, there's no single number that represents the tipping point between an acceptable number of drug therapies and a poly issue. What's more, no medical condition presents the same way in every patient. Complications and comorbidities are the rule, not the exception. The core issue here is not how polypharmacy is defined or the number of medications employed. What's most important is whether the use of multiple drug treatments carries an accompanying therapeutic benefit that manifests discernible symptom improvement in the affected patient. Sometimes it doesn't, because at the first sign of treatment resistance, some prescribers find it necessary to design highly complex drug regimens without a clear rationale or good data, thereby adopting a make-it-up-as-you-go approach. Fueled by a more-is-more belief system, these prescribers tinker with the patient's drug regimen to excess. But polypharmacy can be beneficial by providing more therapeutic options to help patients achieve better outcomes. Too many descriptions carry negative connotations, such as increased costs, poorer compliance, and greater risks of side effects and drug interactions. While these negatives are indeed real, they are not the case for the majority of medicated patients. That is, most patients are medication compliant. Only a relatively small number of drug-drug interactions are important, and generic alternatives for the most commonly prescribed medications are ever increasing. For example, while lithium is often eschewed by prescribers due to its side effects, 2/3 of patients taking lithium describe hardly any adverse effects at all. Multiple medications may be necessary to effectively manage mental health disorders accompanied by physical health problems and other comorbidities. For example, a patient with bipolar disorder, diabetes, and hypertension may require as many as 9 drugs to successfully manage these 3 disease states concurrently. Some would argue that the goal should be to decrease the number of medications in this patient, but it could be that the person truly needs 9 medications. The most important consideration in medication management is to conceptualize a reason for each drug choice. If after thorough analysis of a patient's drug regimen, reasons for the use of certain medications are not apparent, then the patient or the patient's advocate should be encouraged to ask the prescriber for a re-examination of the medication profile. Seeking a second opinion may also be warranted. With continued advances in pharmacological therapies and an ever-increasing pool of medications from which prescribers can choose, polypharmacy will become an even more significant issue in the future. The line between just enough and too much will no doubt be further blurred. Making a medication referral. Throughout the many years I have practiced psychotherapy, the area where I still consistently encounter the most client resistance is the use of medication to augment therapy treatment. Years ago, when I was a novice psychotherapist, I believed that clients would go along willingly with the suggestions and recommendations put forth by their trusted therapist. How wrong I was! Thankfully, what I figured out in relatively short order was this. When it comes to medication, clients will make their own choices on their own terms and in their own time. But even when faced with client ambivalence, I consider it an obligation to voice my views on the most viable, literature-grounded alternatives available. I ensure that my patients have as much information as I can provide so that they can make informed choices about their future treatment. With this in mind, here are a select few of the markers to take into account when considering a referral for psychotropic medication with a patient. First, the patient is not responding favorably to psychotherapy, despite an adequate trial period. For me, this is number one. Next, the patient has a complicated medical history and is taking multiple medications. Never underestimate the negative influence that certain medical disorders and some prescription medications can have on client improvement. Next, the patient hasn't had a thorough physical examination in years. There may be an undiagnosed medical condition that is impinging upon what the client sought treatment for in the first place. The patient initially presents with prominent mood and behavioral instabilities, or mood and behavior become more markedly labile as psychotherapy continues. there's an active and identifiable presence of psychotic features exhibited by the patient. This is evidence of a biologically based disorder for which pharmacological intervention is the mainstay of treatment, with psychotherapy as an adjunct to care. A prolonged personal history or significant family history of mental disturbance. Substance abuse may be associated with the patient that repeatedly experiences relapses after some improvement. Also, many of the disorders discussed are highly heritable. Genetic predispositions often are associated with neurochemical deficits in the brain that can have adverse influence on sustained symptom improvement, unless pharmacotherapy is considered. Medication noncompliance, how healthcare professionals can help. The basic tenet of noncompliance is the failure to take medication according to prescribed directions. But it's more than not adherence to directions. Noncompliance is also indicative of the misuse of medication. Here are five common causes of noncompliance and how healthcare professionals can help. Side effects. In a perfect drug scenario, medications would zero in on their intended target systems, generating only desired therapeutic effects, then metabolize and leave the body. Unfortunately, it's not that simple, as medications produce unintended consequences as well. How healthcare professionals can help. It's important to be honest with clients about side effects. Point out that although practically every drug, prescription and over-the-counter, has side effects, many of them are short-lived and run their course, so to speak, after the body adapts to the new substance. Discuss the typical side effects of the medications that the client is taking and suggest ways for combating them. For example, drugs that are associated with the side effects of anxiety and insomnia are best taken in the morning. Sedating medications should be taken at bedtime, and those linked to nausea are to be consumed on a full stomach. Cost. Unfortunately, most brand-name medications are outrageously expensive nowadays, so it's no surprise that the poor, and particularly the elderly on fixed incomes, are prone to breaking their medications in half or taking them every other day. As important as medication may be to quality of life and even survival, it's not high in the pecking order when it comes to one's hierarchy of needs. How healthcare professionals can help. The place to start is with the client's choice of insurance company or plan. Help them find out about the range of prescription benefits and whether or not the medications they're taking are covered under their plan. Clarify copay information and whether or not brand drugs are covered. This is particularly important if they're taking several medications. Suggest comparison shopping among several pharmacies. There are often disparaging price differences for the same drug from pharmacy to pharmacy. There are also a number of useful websites that can assist clients with comparison shopping. A number of assistance programs are available through states, nonprofits, and drug companies. Contact the Partnership for Prescription Assistance for eligibility requirements. PPA helps the uninsured or those struggling financially to gain access to about 475 assistance programs that are either free or very low cost. Find out if the client's physician is willing to prescribe either a less expensive brand of the medication they're taking or a generic. More and more pharmacies are following Walmart's lead and are offering some generics for as little as $4 per prescription. The purchase of prescriptions via mail order, particularly in larger quantities, offers handsome savings in many instances. Forgetfulness. Forgetting to take medication according to prescribed directions is the most common cause of noncompliance. It is often the result of poor organization, memory compromise, and sometimes downright obstinance. That is, some people conveniently forget. How healthcare professionals can help. Pill boxes, medication calendars, post-it note reminders, timers, and even high-tech talking devices that sound an alarm when a dose is missed are all helpful. Help clients set up a strategy for taking medications at the same time every day, and enlist the help of family members whenever possible. Available and supportive family members can either administer medication directly to the client or remind them via a phone call. The key here is to set up a clockwork pattern of daily repetition for the consumption of medication. The I'm cured syndrome. Far too many people treat prescribed medication as they would a Tylenol for a simple, uncomplicated tension headache. That is, once they either begin to feel better or their symptoms remit, they abruptly stop or gradually discontinue the drug. The reasoning for this action, albeit illogical, is simple. Most people want to be done with medication as quickly as possible because it is viewed as a necessary evil. For many, having to take medication serves as an ever-present reminder of something undesirable, such as a physical illness or mental disorder. How healthcare professionals can help. This one can be tough and is at times met with resistance. But clients need to be reminded that medication is a vehicle that has fostered improvement in the first place, and that abrupt or gradual discontinuation isn't warranted without the approval or recommendation from the client's prescriber. Some clients need to bluntly hear that this is a matter they shouldn't take into their own hands. Frequency of use. The more times per day someone has to take a medication, the greater the frequency of a missed dose. It's that simple. There's also a multiplier effect associated with frequency of use that is exacerbated in the client taking multiple medications. This can make for a real mess. How healthcare professionals can help. Research whether the client's medication is possibly available in a once-daily formulation. If so, teach them how they can advocate with their physician on their own behalf for once-daily preparations. Are all drugs created equal? Brand name versus generic medications. Are low-priced generic medications as safe and effective as their brand name counterparts? Well, it depends. Specifically, it depends on whom you ask, comparative studies, biases, and personal experience. All four of these issues figure prominently into determining the answer to this question. Here's more detail. Whom you ask. Ask a brand name drug manufacturer, and they will obviously claim that their medications are better than generics. After all, brand-name drugs are subject to rigorous FDA clinical trials and are tested more thoroughly on patients than generics. When FDA approved, brand-name drugs reap price benefits and patent protection for as much as 20 years. Prices for brand-name drugs reflect the steep research and development expenditures associated with the developing, testing, and getting drugs to market, the companies say. But ask a manufacturer of generic medicines, and they will say their products are every bit as effective as their brand name counterparts. This is because the FDA requires generics to be bioequivalent. This means the generic medication must contain the same active ingredients as the brand name equivalent. And when taken by patients, they must also produce similar results. Therefore, one should expect a generic to be as safe and effective as a brand medication. Comparative studies. In a recent study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, researchers compared generic and brand name drugs for the treatment of heart and artery disease. They studied beta blockers, diuretics, statins for high LDL cholesterol, and warfarin, a blood thinner, some of the most commonly prescribed medications worldwide. 38 of the studies were randomized controlled trials, indicative of high reliability. Of these 38 studies, 36 found no real difference between generic and brand. Yet some physicians remain concerned. They point out that the bioequivalent studies used by the FDA to predicate its decisions aren't made public. As a result, doctors have no way of knowing when the FDA has found a difference, nor do they know how telling the difference, if any, might be. Physicians are also unable to learn about differences in fillers and other additives, which might change the rates of release. Perhaps that's why only 12 of 43 medical journal commentaries on the subject encourage the use of generics. Biases. Biases tend to be influenced by our belief systems, and they exist in practically every area of our lives. Medication is no exception. If you're the CEO of a pharmaceutical company, you're likely biased in favor of brand-name drugs. If, on the other hand, you're living on a fixed income and have encountered no ill effects from generics, it's likely you will favor them. Personal experience. Previous experience weighs heavily on future choices and decisions. For example, if a patient switches from a name brand drug to a generic drug and notices no difference in their health, they will be likely to believe that generics can be readily substituted for brand name products. But if the same patient experienced new side effects or diminished effectiveness with the generic medication, they might be more skeptical of the switch. In both cases, the person's opinion would have been affected by their personal experience. Further, this is essentially anecdotal evidence based on a sample of just one person and therefore unscientific. In a similar manner, the way physicians view generic medications often is closely associated with the experiences of their patients. In today's medical environment, prescribing habits have changed. Most physicians either accept or have been influenced into generic substitution by the rigorous cost-conscious practices of third-party insurers. If a patient complains, though, doctors will usually not hesitate to change a prescription back to its brand name version. The bottom line: personal accounts, comparative studies, biases, and personal experience aside, the FDA is satisfied with the performance of generic drugs. The placebo effect. The placebo effect is likely as old as the healing professions themselves. In the classic placebo effect, a person consciously believes that a substance is therapeutic, and this belief generates a positive effect on medical or psychological symptom improvement. Over the centuries, doctors have purposely used inactive substances when they had no suitable medications to treat certain medical maladies. Today, the placebo effect is alive and well. In numerous field trials, people in the placebo groups have been found to improve at least as much as people in the drug group, though the conscious belief that what they received generated a positive effect on their medical or psychological symptom improvement. More specifically, placebos have demonstrated positive results in the treatment of depression, pain, asthma, arthritis, hypertension, insomnia, and other conditions. Placebos have even been found to have a positive response when the person knows they are taking a placebo. For several decades, scientists and researchers have known that placebo effects can also arise from subconscious associations. Any stimuli that a patient may link with symptom improvement, a physician's white lab coat, a physical examination, the touch of the stethoscope to the chest, even the smell of alcohol in the examining room, may induce positive physiological responses. This can be true even when a patient has no explicit belief or faith in the treatment being administered. The placebo effect probably accounts for most of the benefits associated with treatments such as acupuncture, aromatherapy, homeopathy, and other alternative treatments. It also accounts for success with more conventional treatments. For example, half of all responses to antidepressants are attributable to the placebo effect, according to the American Psychological Association. Conditions linked to significant psychological distress are most likely to respond to placebo. Some possible mechanisms for this are as follows. Psychological theory. Psychology affects biology. Beliefs affect biochemistry. The old, if you want to change the way you feel, change the way you think adage. Nature takes its course. We often get better by doing nothing at all, allowing the body to heal itself. Process of treatment. Touching, when appropriate, displaying a caring attitude, being attentive and communicating effectively may elicit a placebo response. Using the placebo effect. Inspire patient confidence by acting and dressing professionally. Display symbols of comfort in your office. These may include soothing artwork, positive affirmations, or the gentle sound of water trickling from a mini fountain. Discreetly take notes during meetings with the client patient. This indicates client attentiveness, that is, the clinician is immersed in the client's condition. The client equates note-taking with a clinician who will study their case, and this intensifies the client's belief that a positive outcome is likely. Lean slightly forward when addressing the client and asking questions. Leaning forward is a gesture of interest in the client's problem. The client equates this with a clinician who is empathic and cares about them. Solicit the patient's beliefs and input when selecting treatment interventions. Most important, instill hope and optimism when discussing the prognosis of the presenting problem. Finally, consider that the color of a tablet can add a placebo boost to the physiological effects in real, legitimate drugs. For example, yellow pills tend to make the most effective antidepressants, like doses of drug-induced sunshine. Green tablets or capsules reduce anxiety. Looking out over a plush landscape is soothing, and the green color scheme is obvious to us all. And red tablets are associated with a stimulating kick and charged-up sensation. The placebo response couldn't care less if the impetus for healing is due to a pharmacological success, a caring therapist, or an injection of saline. All it requires is someone with a reasonable expectation of getting better. Now that's powerful medicine. Okay, our next section is Frequently Asked Questions. I'll read a number of questions often asked of me and follow with my answers. Here goes. Question: why do so many antidepressants seem to cause sexual dysfunction? Answer: in addition to its antidepressant effects, serotonin is a rather powerful vasoconstrictor. It can restrict blood flow to sexual organs and negatively impact sexual performance, libido, and the ability to reach orgasm. Question: what is the safety profile of the SSRIs? Answer: from a potential for overdose perspective, they are actually incredibly safe. Death by SSRI overdose, according to some published reports, occurs in only about 2 of every 1 million individuals using them. Question: how does Cymbalta differ from Effexor? Answer: well, both are classified as serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, SNRIs. However, Cymbalta has garnered FDA approval for the management of diabetic neuropathic pain, diabetic neuropathy, as well as for major depressive disorder. Question: is the diagnosis of pediatric bipolar disorder on the rise? Answer: definitely yes. According to a commentary in the December 2007 Harvard Mental Health letter, office visits by children diagnosed with bipolar disorder multiplied 40-fold from 1994 to 2003. The number of office visits per 100,000 children rose from 25 to 1,003 in the same period. Question: why is Topamax linked to weight loss in some subjects? Answer: well, Topamax is an interesting drug, to say the least. Reports indicate that it was originally developed as an anti-diabetic agent, but that didn't come to pass. There's some evidence that Topamax improves insulin sensitivity, and with better management of glucose, weight loss can occur. Question: are recent reports regarding sleepwalking, sleep eating, and sleep driving with Ambien true? Answer: yes, but the number of reported cases is still small. Nevertheless, some people using Ambien report objective evidence of having engaged in these behaviors, with no recollection the next day of having done so. In rare instances, Ambien may disrupt the sleep-wake cycle in some users. Question: are Risperdal and Invega similar? Answer: Invega is actually an active metabolite of Risperdal. Thus, their antipsychotic actions are similar. However, Invega has an extended release delivery system that allows for once-daily dosing, unlike Risperdal. Question: is Wellbutrin effective in treating ADHD? Answer: yes, although primarily as an augmenting agent to the methylphenidate and dextroamphetamine-type psychostimulants, which are the mainstay of treating ADHD. Wellbutrin is also effective in treating ADHD and comorbid depression. Question: in treating ADHD, are there any advantages to using Vyvanse over Adderall XR? Answer: both ostensibly provide 10 to 12-hour symptom coverage, but Vyvanse needs to be completely absorbed via the gastrointestinal tract before converting to its active ingredient, dextroamphetamine, thus minimizing the risk that this compound can be abused through the intranasal and intravenous route, or even smoked. Question: is Deplin an antidepressant? Answer: no. Deplin is actually a methylfolate preparation. Depressed patients consistently have lower serum folate concentrations. Deplin helps normalize amounts of the neurotransmitters norepinephrine, serotonin, and dopamine, thus enabling antidepressants to be more effective. Question: why do so many psychotropic medications seem to cause weight gain? Answer: psychiatric medications which are linked to weight gain typically slow down the metabolism of carbohydrate and fat. Also, some psychotropics, such as the antipsychotics Clozaril and Zyprexa, interfere with satiety. People taking these medications often continue to eat and eat, particularly sugars, without feeling full. Question: will consuming alcohol prevent or diminish the potential positive effects of an antidepressant? Answer: given the complexity of individual biochemistry, the answer to this question is difficult to nail down, but it certainly depends on the quantity and frequency of alcohol use. There are a few studies indicating that any amount of alcohol, even just one alcoholic beverage, can lead to a diminished antidepressant response. I routinely recommend to those using antidepressants that they consume no more than 2 alcoholic beverages a week. Question: when diagnosing depression in a client, how concerned should I be about identifying specific depression subtypes? Answer: the important issue here is whether labeling a depression by subtype assists the clinician in treating the client more effectively. With few exceptions, the answer is no. Subtypes are generally poor predictors of treatment response. There are some exceptions, however. Seasonal affective disorder may respond to light therapy, as well as antidepressants. And psychotic depressions all but always require antidepressant treatment augmented with antipsychotics. Question: how long does it take for Zoloft, Paxil, Effexor, and Wellbutrin to take effect? Answer: at least 50% of those who will eventually respond to the above-mentioned antidepressants will begin to demonstrate improvement within 1 or 2 weeks of treatment initiation. Users most often report an increase in energy and productivity, coupled with a decrease in sensitivity. Remission of mood symptoms is tougher. Because depression is neurotoxic, this may span over an 8 to 12 week period. Question: should adults take ADD drugs? Answer: absolutely, adults should take them. 70% of those diagnosed with ADD in childhood or adolescence go on to experience symptoms in adulthood. If untreated, these adults will struggle with distractibility and inattention throughout their entire lives. Question: is bipolar disorder more difficult to diagnose in children than in adults? Answer: yes. Bipolar disorder is actually very hard to diagnose in children, mostly because of the high incidence of multiple coexisting disorders with symptom overlap seen in children. The prime example of a coexisting condition with symptom overlap is ADHD. 2 of the symptoms, presumed to evidence of a mood disorder, bipolar, irritability, and hyperactivity, are also key criteria for an ADHD diagnosis. Another issue complicating the diagnosis of BPD in children is that there's no consensus on how to measure symptom severity. If a child is perceived as disruptive, it could be that his or her behavior deviates wildly from the mean, or it could be that the diagnosing clinician is overly intolerant of unruly behavior. Question: is ADHD being overdiagnosed or underdiagnosed? Answer: well, the answer is both. Overdiagnosis is an issue because academic expectations of American children are rising and occurring at an earlier age. Children are expected to sit longer, concentrate more, stay focused, and read and write earlier. Also, class sizes are increasing at the same time teachers are expected to meet the needs of every child. Parents are also stressed. Children are hurried from one activity to another. There is less family time. All of these factors contribute to a child not focusing and paying attention. But ADHD is also underdiagnosed. A child can be labeled as bad when he continually engages in a behavior that is viewed as purposeful and within his control. The child is then often asked to try harder, which is actually outside of his control. Question: what questions should clients ask when having a psychiatric medication evaluation? Answer: Many clients develop white coat brain lock when it comes to asking questions, particularly on the first visit, because of one of the most prevalent communication gaps is between doctors and patients. On a 3x5 index card, have your client write down the following 5 questions and recommend that they ask these after the doctor has completed the initial assessment and has evaluated the client's history and presenting symptoms. First question, what do you think is wrong with me? Second question, what might be causing this? Third, what else could it be? 4, is there more than one treatment for my disorder? 5, would you please tell me about the medication you're prescribing for me? The average length of a general practice physician office visit nowadays is 7 minutes. So as simple as they may be, these questions often go unanswered due to the flurry of activity in physician offices. So clients have to empower themselves to maximize the benefits of office visits. And an empowered client is usually a compliant client. All right, let's wrap up with future challenges for psychopharmacology. What will be the next big thing in psychopharmacology? Research in this field is constantly ongoing, with new discoveries and possibilities emerging all the time. Approximately 8% of people take psychotropic medication, and psychotropic drug use in children has tripled in just 10 years. Not surprisingly, medication designed to affect brain chemistry that regulates mood represents the hottest segment of the pharmaceutical market. According to industry analysts, drugs for depression will enjoy a growing demand. As of 2008, 44 medications currently under development focus on depression. In fact, the World Health Organization predicts that depression will become the leading contributor to the global burden of disease by the year 2020. Since the 1980s, drug companies' investment in central nervous system research has been unprecedented, with drugs for anxiety and depression leading the pack. Prozac was the superstar of the 1990s. What do we see coming down the drug pipeline in coming years? Well, I believe the wave of the future in managing anxiety and depression will likely focus on the association between stress hormone secretion and the wide range of resulting physiological responses. 2 of these stress hormones are corticotropin-releasing factor, CRF, and substance P. Both of these coordinate responses to stress. They are released through the hypothalamus. Excessive secretion can lead to possibly debilitating states of anxiety and subsequent depression. For example, excessive levels of CRF have been found in the cerebrospinal fluid of suicide victims. As of this writing, there are no medications on the U.S. market that address this issue. Increasing attention is being paid to the stress hormone cortisol. Cortisol overproduction has been linked to changes in blood sugar levels and blood pressure, fat redistribution, especially accumulation around the middle, immune system compromise, an infection waiting to happen, and the shrinkage of brain cells. Substance P has been associated with regulating anxiety, stress, and mood disorder. Substance P functions as a neurotransmitter, especially with regard to pain impulses from peripheral receptors to the central nervous system. The higher the level of substance P, the more efficient the pain transmission system. While it's impossible to predict which new drugs will survive development, research and testing, and eventually make it all the way to market, teams of well-educated and highly experienced professionals worldwide will continue to seek the next breakthroughs in psychopharmacology. Their efforts may very well be devoted toward the observable and measurable characteristics that define mental illnesses by gene expression, RNA fingerprint, brain mapping, brain imaging, and DSM categories with a track record of medication responsiveness. I can imagine a day when a clinician, faced with a client who has major depression, will be able to order a gene scan that will predict response to a certain medication. Advances in neuroscience will clarify the underlying pathology of mental disorders, thereby paving the way for taking the guesswork out of what medication will work for whom. This will ease the burden on medication prescribers considerably. Gone will be the days of vague diagnosis that relies too heavily on client self-report. About the author of this audio presentation. Joe Wegman's a licensed clinical pharmacist and clinical social worker with more than 30 years of experience in the field of psychopharmacology. His diverse professional background in psychopharmacology and counseling affords him a unique perspective on medication management issues. In addition to consulting with numerous psychiatric facilities, Joe has presented psychopharmacology seminars to thousands of clinicians in 46 states. Joe's book, Psychopharmacology: Straight Talk on Mental Health Medications, now in its second edition, is available from PESI. That's www.pesi.com and amazon.com. Again, Joe's book, Psychopharmacology: Straight Talk on Mental Health Medications, now in its second edition, is available from PESI, www.pesi.com and amazon.com. Visit Joe online at The Pharmatherapist. That's www.pharmatherapist.com. www.pharmatherapist.com. Thanks for joining me for this audio presentation. Hope you enjoyed it.